The next matter on our oral calendar this morning is Prasad versus Leary. Council, as you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. We only keep track. We only provide a public audio recording of the proceedings, and so in order for the public to be aware of who's attached to which argument, we would ask that you state your name at each stage of your presentation today. The timing restrictions are indicated in the podium, both in light and in a clock. Please be mindful of those restrictions as you provide your arguments. And there is a button in the front of the lectern. It allows you to raise or lower it so the platform is at your convenience and at your height. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeremy Legassi, representing the appellant, Balwant Prasad, in this matter. Our appeal is of the dismissal by the Dakota County District Court judge with regard to personal jurisdiction as a result of the determination that, one, substitute service was not successful, or, two, that in the alternative, we did not meet the requirements of secondhand service because, in part, it has never been formally adopted by the Supreme Court and identified in keeping with the rules. With regard to the substitute service issue, the standard is that matters of personal jurisdiction may be reviewed de novo, but the findings of the district court judge are reviewed for being clearly erroneous. And in this particular case, there appears to be, with respect to the language of 402 and 403, no dispute other than with respect to the determination regarding the usual place of abode. So in this matter, the process server, which, to back up for a moment, the matter arises out of a September 27, 2016 motor vehicle accident. And otherwise, it was served close to the expiration of the statute of limitations. The process server, in response to a skip trace, identifies the defendant, Kyle Leary, at his family home in Rosemount. So on September 1st, brings with her the summons and complaint and presents it to Miss Lisa Leary. Miss Leary is the mother of Kyle Leary, and presents it to her, makes it very clear what it is, affidavit of service dated September 8th of 2022. Ms. Leary receives the summons and complaint. There's no dispute that Ms. Leary was the resident of that home, that was the, you know, place of her residence, and that she otherwise received it and knew what it was. The issue is whether or not the district court judge, who determined that Mr. Leary was, quote, not living at the Rosemount address on September 1st of 2022, was clearly erroneous, or that
You left out one little detail.
Please.
I think. I spoke to Lisa Leary. This is the process server. Kyle's mom. Here's the part you didn't highlight. She said he moved out last Friday and now lives in Ridgefield.
That information is correct. That's what the testimony was. That was the information that the process server recorded. And as indicated in the July 31st, I believe, 2023 affidavit of the process server, which otherwise memorialized the contemporaneous notes that she drafted at the time that the service was effectuated on September 1st of 2022, she mentions there that it's not uncommon that people who receive a summons and complaint would otherwise lie to a process server. With respect to her son, who had lived in that home consistently for 27 years, his entire life, according to his testimony, for her to not know what the address is, but to, quote, know how to get there, seems implausible, but the record before the district court judge indicates that this was indeed what she told the process server. However, the position that the district court judge took was that there is, you know, an absolute statement, not living at the Rosemount address. And so usual place of abode is one of those issues that we have to contend with. Mr. Leary had maintained that residence his entire life, continued to maintain mail there.
So just so I'm understanding your argument right now, you're arguing as a matter of fact that we should base our decision on the assumption that he did live in his mother's home at the time that the process server said that she was told that he had moved out the previous Friday and now lives in a different city. You want us to base our decision on him living there in his mother's house, am I correct?
Well, what I want you to do is to look at the determinations, which the findings of fact in the district court's order are a little bit confusing because they're recitation. But what I want you to do is review the determinative statements in the decision.
But ultimately,
as clearly erroneous.
After we've done that, you want us to conclude that because it was clearly erroneous, we should base our decision on the fact that he lives not in Richfield, but in his, still lives in his mother's home on the day of the service.
Yes.
At her home. That's your argument.
That is, yes. And the reason for that is clear in not just the briefing, but because it matters what the usual residence of the person is, where they can usually be found. With respect to Mr. Well,
it's not where they usually can be found. I think we have to be very careful. The Supreme Court in Berryhill talked about the usual place of abode, meaning the present place of abode. In other words, what is one's fixed place of residence for the time being? And so the district court clearly found that Leary had moved out of his mother's home on August 26th.
And that's what Mrs. Leary's statement is, but it in the
well,
record.
It's not just her statement. That's a finding by the district court. So unless that finding is clearly erroneous, we have to accept that as a finding and a basis for the district court's ultimate determination that process had not been properly served.
With the exception of reviewing the totality of the record before the district court judge, which indicates that Mr. Leary had not completed his transfer of abode to the Richfield address until he had removed the remainder of his living things from the Rosemount address, which he had declared as his primary residence
well,
for his entire
but
life
not
before
so much
that.
Where, I mean, I don't know if it makes common sense to think that when somebody moves out, all of a sudden, boom, instantly you flip a switch and everything is moved out and everything is transferred nice and neatly, cleanly. I'm not sure if that's, and I think the district court implicitly found, okay, yeah, well, you know, he stops by, that's where he lived for 27 years. He didn't transfer his mail immediately. You know, that's not uncommon either. But where is he actually living now? And I think that's what we need to look at as to whether or not the district court's finding is supported by the record or not.
And I don't think it is supported by the record, because if it were supported by the record, then I think it would have taken into, the judge would have taken into consideration the testimony.
What do you mean not supported by the record? I guess this is where I'm stuck. You're asking us, as you put it, we need to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine where he lived. And I think that that's not our standard for determining whether a fact finding is clearly erroneous. I think what we do then is we look to see whether there is something that would support the district court's finding a fact, even if we would reach a different finding ourselves on the totality of circumstances, unless it's so clear, hence the clear error standard, that we're left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made. And we have a statement from the process server that the process server was told that he was, by the mom, that he moved out. So we've got a statement by mom, he no longer lives there. We have testimony, he no longer lives there. And you're asking us to say, district court, you clearly erred by crediting that testimony. And I'm assuming that you have a a different argument, and you're not hanging your hat just on that, but if I'm wrong, correct me.
Yes, Mr. Leary testified that he spent the weekend, so the date identified, that September 27th through the 29th, the entire purpose of that weekend where there was moving going on wasn't the moving out of his parents' home, despite what Mrs. Leary testified to. He testifies that he spends that weekend getting his fiance's belongings out of her Rosemount condo. The whole purpose was so that she avoided the payment of rent in September. It wasn't his circumstance, it was hers. He comes back to the home after September 1st. He testifies specifically that that was an intention that he had to return to the home to grab, quote, some more stuff. And with respect to that intention, I think
some more stuff, which indicates that stuff had already been moved out of his mother's home.
I would correct that only in as much as the record reflects that he was removing things that he possessed from his girlfriend's Rosemount condo and bringing it to this Richfield apartment.
I thought you were referring to getting more stuff out of his parents' home, his mother's home.
He testifies to more stuff, and I with respect to the deposition transcripts, I believe you have them in your possession. They're very muddled. The testimony is certainly muddled, but he makes it abundantly clear that he intends to return to the family home. He's going back home to grab more things to effectuate that transfer of abode.
Clear on your argument. You're conceding then that if we choose not to determine the fact finding as to where he lived on that date as clearly erroneous, we should affirm.
Yes, if you don't find that it's clearly erroneous, you have to. You have to give deference to the district court judge, except that the district court judge did not take into consideration the evidence before him, which was the testimony that Mr. Leary intended to return.
What's the point of relying upon the Eighth Circuit decision then?
Well,
that would also be irrelevant if your argument depends on where he lived at the time.
Well, in the alternative, the argument that we have for substitute service deals with the question of whether or not the person of Mrs. Leary effectively became the process server.
So you're not conceding. I'm confused by your argument.
I'm
a
sorry.
Minute ago, I thought you were conceding when I asked you the question. You were conceding that we should affirm if he didn't live there at his mom's home at the time. Now
On the basis of substitute service, Your Honor, I apologize. So to distinguish, I think that we have met our burden to show that the district court judge clearly erred by ignoring significant testimony evidence in the record.
You've got 3 minutes left, so assume, for the sake of the next 3 minutes, I'm not saying that's what the panel will do, assume we're not persuaded by the argument and that you need to rest on your alternative argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. So in the alternative, the argument is that the court should recognize that the plain language of 4.02 and 4.03 otherwise confers the ability on anyone over 18 and not a party to serve a summons and complaint on another by virtue of their fitting the categories.
No, how? But serve how? Doesn't
yes.
Doesn't the rule require either delivery to the individual personally, even if it's by a second person, or leaving, and that's what, in the Eighth Circuit case, that's what Judge Strauss, not in his role as Supreme Court Justice, but in his role as Eighth Circuit judge, said. That was a circumstance there where you had an actual delivery by father to the individual who was subject to the summons. In our case, the district court did not find that there was a hand delivery, but that it may have been just left there or shown to your client. And if that's so, how is the statute met? Because the statute requires, or the rule requires, delivery to the individual, or if you're going to leave it or show it and make it available, it has to be at the individual's usual place of abode.
So with respect to the reading of the Michaud case, I mean, it's clear that the court is reviewing the plain language of the rule. Miss Leary ends up receiving the summons and complaint. There's no dispute that she received it. She otherwise then gets instruction from an attorney that doesn't represent her and the insurance company that she doesn't have to track him down. But if you take the testimony in its entirety, Mr. Leary comes back to the home, gets his hands on the summons and complaint, talks to his mother, talks to his father and his fiancée, and they're a complete household.
He gets his hands on it. Did she actually deliver it to him?
Well,
Isn't that what's required?
The surrendering of the document, absolutely.
The surrendering is different than delivering.
The court has previously interpreted that it has to be received in hand. There has to be a handoff.
Right.
Mr.
Is there any evidence? The district court in this case was not convinced that there was that handoff. So am I correct that you would like us, in your alternative argument, also to deem the district court's finding as clearly erroneous?
Absolutely. The statement by the district court judge is, quote, no information. Had the judge given there some qualification in the statement, I would say that would present a greater hurdle for us. But he went so far as to say no information. How do you understand the judge to have then?
No, the district court said there was no delivery. There's no evidence of a delivery in the sense of handing it from mom to son.
Well,
is there a fact that would lead us to have that definite and firm conclusion that the district court clearly erred in that finding?
Yes, the testimony of Mr. Leary stating that he returned to the home, got his hands on the summons and complaint, and then discussed it with the family.
Got his hands on.
Well, he doesn't testify that he found it in the driveway. He doesn't testify that he found it on the table. He doesn't testify that it came in a fax.
He doesn't testify that it was handed to him by his mother. So I'm asking you, what is there something that would lead us to say, you know, district court, you said there was no evidence that it was actually delivered, hand-delivered. And so we're going to say you're clearly erroneous because the testimony exactly says what?
The testimony says I got my hands on it, but the district court judge's finding isn't no evidence of delivery. It's, quote, no information. That's plainly wrong. The testimony that Mr. Leary returned to the home later that week because he intended to grab his things, received the summons and complaint by hand, that was completely disregarded despite the fact that it was in the record before the judge. And I think that on that basis alone, you have the ability to determine the finding clearly erroneous and that Mrs. Leary otherwise knew what the document was and intended to give it to him despite the instruction of the insurance company and the attorney that didn't represent her. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tania Lex Olson, and I represent the respondent, Kyle Leary, in this matter. Quite honestly, after the questions posed to my opposing counsel, I'm not sure how much argument I have left, but I'll proceed anyway. I would like to focus my argument on the standard of review in this case, which does seem to be the primary issue in dispute among the parties and how to interpret the clearly erroneous standard. I would also note that in appellant's principal brief and then further expanded upon in appellant's reply brief, they seem to infer that the court has a third standard of potential review to consider, which is a prima facie standard in which the court accepts all factual allegations and complaints in the supporting affidavit as true. I don't think that's applicable here. The appellant cites Bandmar versus Ford Motor Company for that standard of review. That case is not it's not a service case. It's a case that the court was considering a question of personal jurisdiction in the context of whether the defendant in that case had achieved minimum contacts with the state of Minnesota, according to be sued.
Was the district court correct in its legal analysis as to how to determine this, how to apply the Malelo case, this substitute delivery?
The district court in the present case,
yes.
On Malelo? Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
the district court said the court finds, based on the record before it, that there is no evidence that Ms. Leary intended to be a process server. Is that the standard that Supreme Court case law establishes, that that's what's meant by knowing and intentional, intending to be the process server?
Your Honor, I'm not actually sure that is the appropriate analysis in that particular.
What is the appropriate analysis?
I think the requirements for service are knowing and intentional, and I think that...
And the intentional part means what?
The intent is the intent to deliver. I don't know that there is an additional required intent of intent to be a process server aside from the intent to deliver, which as...
So the district court was wrong in that part of the analysis.
I do think the district court got that
wrong. And
why
isn't that a reason why you should reverse?
Because the court got it right on the question of delivery, Your Honor, and delivery is a... supersedes the issue of whether there was intent. If there was no delivery, intent to deliver is obviously irrelevant. You can't intend to do something that you didn't do. I think the district court's finding regarding delivery is supported by the evidence. As Your Honor's pointed out, the standard of review on the court's factual findings is the clearly erroneous standard. And
does the record tell us how Kyle got his hands on the summons and complaint?
It does not, Your Honor, and that's the problem, why there is no evidence in this case that there was any delivery. Getting one's hands on a summons and complaint could be consistent with that complaint having been handed to the defendant by his mother. There were no follow-up questions asked in the deposition regarding how he got his hands on it. It's equally consistent with being over at his parents' house, seeing it on the kitchen table, picking it up and looking at it, and putting it down, which would not constitute delivery under the Patterson versus Wu case or under the Webster's Dictionary definitions that the appellant has relied on. Accordingly, I think that the court has properly weighed the evidence on delivery in this case.
Would it be enough if he went to mom's house and the document was sitting on the table and mom said, look, there it is. That's the summons and complaint I was talking to you about. And then he picks it up. Isn't that delivery?
I don't think so, Your Honor. First, there are no facts in the record to establish that that's what actually happened. However, I think saying, look, here it is not the same as giving a copy to the defendant to keep, which is the Patterson versus Wu standard. Regardless, that's not a fact in the record that the district court had to consider in this case.
That seems to be getting awfully close to delivery, though, doesn't it?
Sure. I'll concede that that's getting close to delivery. Once again, regarding the clearly erroneous standard, as this court has pointed out in questions, it's not the function of this court to reweigh the evidence, but rather to defer to the factual findings of the court, even if there may be evidence in the record that could support the opposite conclusion. The question before the court today is whether the district court's findings are supported by the evidence, and in this case, they clearly are. The district court looked at where the defendant's usual place of abode was, where he was actually living at the time of the attempted service. There's no dispute on the law here. There's no dispute on what usual place of abode means. That's not part of the question before this court today. It's simply a question of fact. And both the Lundgren and the Jagger versus Palladium Holdings cases discuss the fact that usual place of abode is a question of fact for the court, and that it's a question of fact that should be reviewed for clear error.
Your brief argues that we should distinguish the Eighth Circuit case based upon the idea that in that case, there was knowledge by the process server about residence, and in this case, or there wasn't, and in this case, there was knowledge. That doesn't seem to be I'm lost as to how that would logically be a basis to distinguish that case from this one. Why would it matter if, in fact, substitute service is allowable? Why would it matter if the father found the son and handed the daughter handed the complaint to her? Why does it matter? Or in this case, why would it matter whether Ms. Leary told the process server that her son lived there or didn't live there if she took the document and handed it to the son?
That's a good point, Your Honor, and I'll concede that's not my strongest argument for why Michaud should not apply. I think that the difference is that perhaps in the Michaud case, It was easier for the court to find that delivery had occurred just based on the fact that the father implied that the daughter was still living at the home. I think it's a more, it's a stronger argument for not adopting secondhand service. First of all, if the court affirms the district court's finding on delivery, the legal issue regarding secondhand service doesn't even need to be addressed by the court. But if the court does find that the district court was clearly erroneous on its finding regarding delivery, first off, Mashaud is not binding precedent. But second, I think the Mashaud court has misanalyzed the Malilo decision regarding secondhand service. The Mashaud court indicated that Malilo set up a court, a future court, to adopt secondhand service, and Malilo does nothing of the sort. It's not a secondhand service case. It's a mail service case. The court indicated that mail service is mail service, and the rules for mail service, there are seven different requirements in the rule that were not all complied with, and accordingly, mail service was not perfected. There was a secondary argument in that case in which there was an argument that the mailman, post officer, who delivered the envelope to the defendant in that case could become a process server, and accordingly, there's some potential argument regarding secondhand service there. The court didn't address whether secondhand service.
I didn't see, frankly, any illogic to Judge Strauss's Mashaud decision. I mean, if why does it matter that the person who is intentionally delivering what is known to be a complaint and summons, why is there a requirement that that person be a process server? I mean, if the process server is on the way to serve process and falls over and, you know, breaks her leg and summons someone on the street and says, hey, would you please, this is a summons and complaint, would you please go hand this to that person right there? And the rule says you just have to be over 18.
Sure.
Why does it matter that it's a process server or if it's the same person who received the process from the attorney or the party who's serving it?
And I would agree with your analysis. I don't think the Mashaud court was mistaken when it says that the rule, the specific language of the rule, does not preclude secondhand service. I'm not sure there's any reason to adopt secondhand service as a new method of service in the common law.
I'm just suggesting that secondhand, the whole notion of secondhand service, what does that mean? A person other than the process server is the one who hands it to the, who delivers it. But there's no requirement in the rule that it be firsthand service.
I would agree with Your Honor on that. The appellant had pointed to two cases regarding in other jurisdictions where secondhand service was in which, in a fairly similar situation to the one at hand, the court had adopted secondhand service. But then the Pritchard case rejected it outright, and I don't recall the reasoning of the court in rejecting it. They had cited it for the dissent, which argued in favor of secondhand service. But once again, I think that the inquiry in this case really ends with the factual findings of the district court on delivery, and I don't think those factual findings are clearly erroneous. For that reason, I would respectfully request that the court would affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you. Doesn't appear to be any further questions.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you'd like to use it.
May it please the court. This is Jeremy Legassi, representing Balwant Prasad in the appeal of the dismissal by the district court judge. With respect to the secondhand service, I appreciated the comment, what does it mean? It seems as though the plain language of the rule would otherwise allow for the method, so long as you met the very basic criteria of being over 18 or 18 and older and not a party. Should the court have wished to provide some other requirements for deputization, certification, they could have done so. They've done so with interpreters, such as in Minnesota General Rule of Practice 8. There's a certification process and a roster. That's not the case here. And with respect to recognizing such a rule, I would suggest that it would be of limited applicability. And otherwise, despite its limited application, could have a tremendous impact, and in particular on my client's case. I would otherwise request that you determine the finding of the district court judge that there is no information regarding delivery as clearly erroneous based on the totality of the evidence.
Well, I mean, the district court said that there's, I mean, ultimately the question is whether there was delivery. If there was no delivery, then your alternative argument fails. So however the district court described it, we still would have to look for some evidence in the record that establishes clearly, leaving us with a conviction that the district court made a mistake. There was delivery. There was a handoff by Ms. Leary to your client. And I'll give you one more shot. I don't know that you've articulated what that evidence is that leads only to that conclusion rather than just that he looked at it while it was sitting on a table in her house.
But that's not his testimony. His testimony was he got his hands on it and then he discussed it with his mother. I think if you took the combination of the communication and getting his hands on it, particularly when she tells the process server by virtue of the affidavit that makes it clear that she would deliver it to her son, when you read those things in combination, he received that complaint from his mother.
But it seems like Judge Ross's example is very fair. He got his hands on it. Oh, he saw it at the table, picked it up, and said, hey, Mom, is this what's this?
Do the facts rule out that possibility? The evidence? Does the evidence rule out that possibility?
No.
Then how would we say that it was clear error?
Because it would otherwise be the result of the phrase, no information by the district court judge. Had there been a qualifying statement or some kind of room for interpretation that there was evidence weighed in the very confusing statement of facts.
You're saying the district court was clearly erroneous in the way that it arrived at the secondary conclusion, which is that there's no evidence that he actually received, that it was delivered to him. That there was some evidence the district court could have pointed to.
Yes.
I think I understand your argument.
That's correct. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The matter is submitted. We will take it under advisement and issue our opinion within this.